Thank you, Johnny. Welcome to Jeopardy. I'm Alex Trebek. Our contestants today are Kion Wolf from Hartford, Connecticut, from Geneva, Switzerland, Mr. Frankenstein, and we're supposed to have Rosemary Fackler from Encino, California, but she doesn't seem to be at her podium.
Oh, she had a little accident in the parking lot, Alex. Somebody tased her.
Really?
Yeah, and she was like, why? And I was like, hey, at least you phrased your answer in the form of a question.
Our time is limited, so let's press on. The categories today are state capitals, oh yeah, widespread panic, things in your pants, and chickens. Mr. Frankenstein, you pick the category.
Hey, Mr. Spare Parts, would a little fire help you see the board? Well, looks like it's just you and me, Alex.
This is unprecedented.
I'll tell you what's unprecedented, Alex. The amount of money you're about to give me. Do you know what the maximum possible score in Jeopardy is if you answered every question, maxed out your daily doubles, and bet everything on Final Jeopardy?
What is $566,400?
Yeah, I want a cashier's check for that amount, and then I'll back out of here and, nobody gets hurt.
Why should I do that?
Because I have Ken Jennings buried in a box with 3 hours of air. He says he loves you, Alex. He's always loved you.
Ken! Okay, here's the money. But people will never love you the way they've loved other champions.
I'm not here to make friends, Alex. I'm here to announce that today on the Nose, we're all about winning. On Jeopardy, The Biggest Loser, The Bachelor, and of course at Sochi. And now, from the new reality show, The Biggest Comfort Level, with his own natural body type, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, I decided not to go on The Biggest Loser. And they should have that. They should have The Biggest Comfort Level with his own body type. But they don't. They don't. And people are not there to make friends. So we're going to be talking, really are dedicating this show today to Charlie Sheen. It's all about winning. And joining us right now is a musician and producer extraordinaire, Jim Chapdelaine, from Trinity Cine Studio, James Hanley, and from The Cut, a magazine exploiting and celebrating Connecticut's ridiculousness, Teresa Kramer. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to save a lot of time for our second segment so we can talk about Sochi. I mean, obviously, we talk about Sochi all day. And we really could talk about Sochi all day. And just things keep happening. Things have happened in the last 2 hours that have changed the picture of that a little bit. But before we even get into that, we did notice a thing that was happening this week, which is people who are in other kinds of contests, many of them on television, would sort of do the thing that maybe made a certain amount of sense if you wanted to win, and people didn't like it that much. So Arthur Chu, a 30-year-old insurance compliance analyst and voiceover artist, is the reigning Jeopardy champion, and he's caused a lot of trouble because he has this he sort of figured it out. He's a games theory guy. He figured out how to win. He jumps around between categories to keep his opponents off base. He's also trying to find all the daily doubles so that he can win them or bet only $5 so you don't get to win them if you're one of his opponents. In other words, he sort of gamed the game, and people don't like it. I think we have a little clip of Arthur Chu defending himself or at least talking about the fact that he's getting a lot of hate on the internet for this. Here he is talking on CNN.
I think some people actually are offended, and my response to them would just be, it's a game and we're playing for real money. So I understand if you find me an unpleasant person or find me unpleasant to watch. My feelings are a little bit hurt by that. But ultimately, you know, it's $10,000 or more every time you win a game of Jeopardy. And my primary concern up there was taking home the money for me and my wife. If you don't think something is sportsmanlike, ultimately you can make a rule against it.
Jim Chapdelaine, I didn't even realize there was sportsmanship in Jeopardy. It never occurred to me.
Apparently there's training. There's all sorts of aerobic workouts you can do to prepare you for this. I'm all for this guy. He's winning. He's winning the game. And I think so far he's won over $100,000. I don't know about you guys, but it takes me at least 2 weeks to make that kind of money. It's serious money. It sort of reminds me of card counting, and I always thought, like, how can these guys stop these card counters? Mm-hmm. Because they're really good at what they do. It's a real skill. But they get to make the rules, and so Jeopardy gets to make the rules, and this guy's playing by the rules and winning the game. So I'm all for him.
Teresa Kramer, is this one of these things that only old people like us care about?
No. I have a slightly different take on this because I don't – apparently he's getting like hate mail and hate tweets and whatnot, and I'm interested in the people who care so much about the game of – I love Jeopardy, but I only like Jeopardy to prove how smart I am to the people in the room. I don't care what's actually happening. I don't care who wins. I don't care who's playing. I hate that part in the middle of the game.
So you enjoy the fact that your dog is sitting there going, wow, yeah. She knows a lot.
Yeah, my dog thinks I'm the smartest.
Can you sing the song?
Yeah. The do-do-do-do. Yeah. And that part in the middle where they come back and they tell you all about the players' lives. I'm like, you're wasting time, Alex. Please get back to the question so I can continue to answer them.
In my house, yeah. We do fast-forward through that part. Mm-hmm. We are not the least bit interested in their lives.
No, they're boring. Yeah. They're usually pretty terrible.
Is it possible that maybe the producers of Jeopardy have a sort of organized hate tweet campaign that lies behind this? I know I'm the conspiracy theorist.
Yes, you absolutely are.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
That is such a great conspiracy.
Wow.
I was primed by the conspiracy over the storm in the South being fake, you know, the snowstorm in the South.
Do you think he actually works for Jeopardy?
Well, I was wondering, it's sort of gotten a lot of news coverage, and actually, I think that this is something.
So do you think he's like the Herbie Stemple of Jeopardy, like a guy they really need to get rid of? Yeah.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
I mean, that would fit, because really.
Colin's lost it.
That's my favorite James Hanley conspiracy ever. That's so good.
Yeah.
I just think that those things, you know, in a way, a show like Jeopardy is kind of like a comforting thing that people think they know, you know, like it's been on for a long time. And they think that, okay, it's people who are really smart and
Uncle
skilled.
Alex is there.
Yeah, right. And it goes on and goes on and goes on. But, of course, as time goes on, those things tend to fade. You know, the audience drops off to other places, and it doesn't necessarily have the freshness that it had before. And then all of a sudden you introduce a total wild card, which is really sort of gaming the actual process and actually having somebody who's skilled enough to figure that out. And then comes this conspiracy theory part of it that you know, you really think. I think that a lot of shows like that and a lot of things just generally in culture, you've got to be completely constantly refreshing them. You've got to constantly provide some reason why people should send out hate tweets, for example.
I know,
because then they'll pay attention.
Having not watched it in 20 years, except for maybe the occasional Saturday Night Live spoof of it, that it is quite updated, that the questions are no longer cardboard flip questions, that it is now.
That actually did happen a long time
ago. Well, I don't know when that happened, but they're actually video questions, right. And some guy comes out and asks you a question, and he's sort of a gamey kind of game show host type of guy, so it struck me as sleek and ultra-modern, so maybe that's part of the conspiracy.
Well, I want to make sure that I completely understand James's conspiracy. There's two ways to look at this. One of them is that Arthur Chu is the Herbie Stemple. Now, Herbie Stemple, for those of you who haven't watched the movie Quiz Show in a while, is at the heart of that figure, that whole story, and he's the reigning champion on this show, but they eventually want somebody a little bit more telegenic and a little bit more symbolic of what America's all about, and they get tired of Herbie for various reasons. And so they've been feeding him answers. Now they make him tank it so they can bring in Charles Van Doren as the new, much more kind of, you know, Aryan, telegenic American champion. So,
right. So now this is getting better, Colin.
Yeah, so now it's an Aryan conspiracy. Yeah.
So that might have been a bad choice of words. So So what the one possibility is we have sort of Alex Trebek and, you know, Merv Griffin Empire sock puppets on the who are just there to beat Arthur Chu down so that they can get rid of him because he's bad for the show. That's one conspiracy. The other conspiracy is that Arthur Chu is actually good for the show, and the more controversial he gets and the more that the Merv Griffin sock puppets attack him on Twitter and elsewhere, the more interest gets focused on the show.
Doesn't he have to be in it?
Arthur?
To really tie this thing up. Arthur
Herbie
has
was.
To be.
I mean,
to
think
be
about
part of it.
Think about the position of the producers here. You've got a show that needs to be refreshed, and you've got a sort of structure that people expect about it. But then you've also got this big beast out there called game theory, which is becoming much more widely explored by people who have time to do it with the powerful computers that they can test it out on. And they begin to see it differently, and they're beginning to think in terms of how the actual procedural nature of how you answer questions and how you win quiz shows and how you deal with Jeopardy, the structure of Jeopardy. And so you've got those two things, and if you're the producer, and you want the show to have a future, you're going to say, well, okay, that's, how do we incorporate this into the new Jeopardy, as it were? And I mean, this publicity is worth its weight in gold. I mean, it's like huge.
If this is your take on Jeopardy, I can't wait to hear The Bachelor.
I cannot wait to hear that.
Yeah, we're just going to go step by step down the ladder into total decadence.
And how would you apply this to Wheel of Fortune?
Yeah, that might not be able to be gamed. So just very quickly, though, I Teresa Graemer, as I also play Jeopardy to impress my dogs. But I kind of like the idea that, I mean, it's all about this, you know, I mean, every once in a while somebody kind of breaks out of the mold, but everybody's so well-behaved on Jeopardy. I kind of like the idea that this guy's a little bit of a rebel anyway. It's like, all right, no, I figured a better way to do it, so.
Yeah, and I'm kind of wondering, you know, now he's sort of outed this this way to beat the system. Like, you don't have to be the smartest guy in the room. Is every guy who's not the smartest guy in the room just going to play this game now? And, or they...
Which could be bad for
Jeopardy. He is pretty smart, though.
Yeah. He is, well, you have to know the right answers. Yeah. I mean, you can't just be a game theory jerk. You have to actually have to be able to supply the content. I sort of wonder about it, too, because Jeopardy's audience is probably a little on the old side, Teresa notwithstanding.
Yeah. And, exactly. That's why they need to refresh it.
Well, except that, you know, older people, this guy's way of playing is very chaotic. You know, he jumps around in the categories. I mean, he screws with it all the time. And I'm sort of wondering, and people may find that a little bit confusing. Maybe he's not good for the game. Anyway, we have to keep plunging along, really through the swamps of television competition shows. So we're going to move from there, and that really this is going to be the high point of our discussion. This is like the highbrow moment of our discussion, because we're moving from there to The Biggest Loser. The Biggest Loser, for people who don't know, I assume people know, is a reality show, sort of slash game show, where except that people really put something on the line, their bodies, and they compete to see who can lose the most weight. I confess I have never actually watched a full episode of The Biggest Loser, but in much the same way that James is suggesting that Arthur Chu has focused the world's attention on Jeopardy to an unprecedented, or at least recently unprecedented, degree, so has the world's attention also been focused on The Biggest Loser, because a contestant, Rachel Fredrickson, took the whole thing very seriously, and she decided to do anything she could to lose weight, and that turned out to be a lot of different things. She began the show at 260 pounds. Last night she weighed in at 105 pounds, setting a show record by losing 60% of her body weight. She has actually dropped below the body mass index that the World Health Organization considers healthy. And she shocked people. She looked emaciated and waif thin. And even the judges at least pretended to look shocked. Or what have you? I don't know if you call them judges or whatever. But Teresa Graemer, good moment for the Biggest Loser, or bad moment?
I don't know Biggest Loser has ever had a good moment. The show is disgusting. But
I was kind of hoping you'd at least watched it. And
I have watched it. I have seen an episode here and there. I've never like devoted myself to a season or anything, but I have seen it. I get the premise. It's gross. Mostly I'm just shocked that it hasn't produced more eating disorders. Well, maybe it has. They just didn't win, so we don't know about it. But she is... I can only hope it brings attention to they berate these people to the point of they get physical at times. It's really just gross what they do to these people, and who are seeking help for a legitimate problem that they have. And to then to go from one way of disordered eating to what is clearly another way of disordered eating is just sort of sad.
Mr. Chaptolay? I'm saving James for last because I know he'll have like a really good, you know.
Well, she will
Hostess
secretly.
Is in on this.
James is going to point out that she is married to Arthur Chu. This contestant is married to Arthur Chu. This is a vast conspiracy. I thought we were going to take a moment to find out a little bit about today's panelists.
Yeah.
So I think, again, she won, how much? $250,000?
You are correct.
Okay. So what do I win? And we see Matthew McConaughey, like, sort of emaciating himself. Maybe Christian Bale, Robert De Niro, all these people. They make even more money to do these things. She's playing a game. Mm-hmm. It's a disgusting game, but she wants to win the game. I've never watched it, nor would I allow it to be aired in my own. But
turn that off now.
But she won the money. You know, she – so who –
I agree with you. I think
I don't really care.
Yeah. Yeah, she made the money. I mean, she took them at face value. I mean, it's an ugly, disgusting paradigm with a disrespect built into it.
Yeah.
And making, celebrating insecurity, really. And she really played their own game. I mean, even if it wasn't a conspiracy for the producers to get noticed, I mean, it certainly she took them on and she won the money. And it is about the money. I mean, she mm-hmm. made the money. But it's an ugly landscape that it took place in.
I would just say two things about this. One of the most seductive notions in sort of American public life is the notion of change. And change has always been something that has been marketed really heavily. I think these days it's being marketed as never before. And so, you know, whether it's some kind of flip your house kind of show where your place, your dwelling place is completely turned around, or some kind of hoarder show where they come in and take all your crap away and try to get you, you know, or shows like this. Or, I mean, I used to love Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. I thought it was a fabulous concept, and but it was also about change. You know, instead of looking like mm-hmm. such a dork or a jock or something, look a little bit cooler.
And you learn how to shave
right.
correctly.
Yeah. So I mean, so change is this very, very seductive notion. I mean, the question is, if it's just done in this very unfettered way, be careful what you wish for, because I mean, change isn't always good. And change, I think the little scenario that we saw this week was what happens when change for the sake of change replaces kind of change with some kind of structured positive outlook. The other thing I would just quickly say about this is that they're also exploiting an interesting idea that comes also out of the world of game theory. I think it's Ian Ayers, but one of the games theory guys down at Yale figured this out a long time ago, that he did some experiments and some studies, I think, about how to help people lose weight. And I actually informally participated in this, which is creating contracts.
You look emaciated, by the way.
No, I unfortunately do not. I am not participating in this right now, but creating contracts where you actually can either win or lose something. But it's also especially helpful if you can lose something, if you don't lose enough weight. So quite a few years ago, I contacted Chris Healy, who was the Republican state chairman of Connecticut, and I explained that I would give him his party $500. I tend to vote Democrat. I would give the Republican Party $500 if I couldn't lose X amount of weight and X amount of time. And then I lost the weight because I didn't want to give them $500. That kind of thinking is actually a pretty helpful way, at least short term, of losing weight. And obviously the incentive of $250,000 would help you do that. I don't know. I'll be interested to see whether she puts all that weight back on, too.
Well, or at least just some weight, because I'm sitting here wondering, like, how much weight did number two lose? Because if number two lost 40% of their body weight and she went to the extremes of losing 60% of her body weight, she just went more overboard than she needed to. But I'm also thinking about that there's another show that like this where they follow one person over the course of a year, mm-hmm. although it's all in one episode, and where they lose an extreme amount of weight. But they do get incentives along the way. It's like if you lose this much in the next 3 months, we'll send you to Disney World. But they're not pitted against each other to win something in the end. So you're trying to achieve a goal, but they set a very clear goal. It's like if you lose 20 pounds in the next 3 months, you don't get anything extra for losing an unhealthy amount of weight in the next 3 months, is probably sort of a better way to do this sort of thing.
So there's no reverse show like What the Heck Happened to You?
Yeah. Yeah. That's called My High School Reunion. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, this game really, when you look at, like, certain games in Japan, like, you know, catch a bullet with your teeth or lose, it sort of pales in comparison to the extremism of those Japanese game shows, which are...
I mean, you feel like we're really missing out somehow?
Well, no, I don't, but I'm thinking there's a culture of this sort of... you know, fascination with extremism on
the fear of some disastrous failure.
Yeah, that we're only just touching the surface of right now. If we get in touch with that Japanese thing, watch out.
All right, we've got one more disgusting reality show to go through. This one's called The Bachelor, and basically what happens on The Bachelor is that a whole group of women present themselves like mandrels and try to get a particular man. In this case, it's a homophobic guy from Argentina?
I think so, Argentina.
He's a temporarily homophobic guy. He's since apologized. He's an apologetic homophobe. Anyway, I have watched the show maybe once or twice in its infancy. I haven't watched it since then, but my recollection is it's all these kind of series of dates and this fairly degrading process in which these women try to worm their way into his affections and be the person that he chooses. And apparently what's happening on the current season, well, first of all, they've had the problem of this guy's homophobic remarks, which he's tried to walk back. But additionally, he started to really like one of these women kind of early. And I guess the way that – have you watched the show too? Are you going to be able to help me out?
I've seen The Bachelor. I have not been watching this season, but I can probably answer your question because Tracy Wu Fastenberg is a huge fan. I'm outing her right now, and she gave me the lowdown
so
before I came here.
She's your lifeline. If we get in trouble, we'll have to call Tracy Wu Fastenberg.
I could call my daughter, she could recite the dialogue.
Okay.
That's like a different show where we have lifelines. But all right, so basically what seems to happen anyway is sort of towards the end of the show, after some of these poor women have been heartlessly culled out of this process, these kind of romantic getaways are arranged for The Bachelor and some of his final choices. Wherein it is assumed or maybe implied that he has sex with those various people. But what happened this time was that he had sex like much earlier in the process, very early in the process, with a woman named Claire. She's 32 years old, and I knew something about her at some point, but I don't see it in my notes.
I think she's a mother.
She's a mother.
Not that I would know.
He's the father. He's also a mother. Oh, yeah. Both of them.
So this would be a blended family.
Well, this is how you get kids. This is how you make children.
Right. And he wants to protect his daughters from gay.
Right. So after this encounter, she sort of came up to him, and I guess all this stuff happens on camera, and kind of, you know, wasn't that great or something. And he sort of rebuked her and said, I hope nobody else knows about this. It shouldn't have happened, blah, blah, blah. And Willa Paskin, the great critic at Slate, said this sort of did unmask, once again, this whole complicated, weird, twisted attitudes that the show has not only about courtship but also about sex. I don't know. Who wants to take this baton away from me?
Well, one of the things I was debating with Tracy today was the last season was supposed – The Bachelor was a born-again virgin, and this is one of the few episodes –
You mean he was a virgin and he was born again?
Yeah. Well,
No, reverse.
Oh, yes. It was reverse. He had not been a virgin, and then he was
not, and then he declared his virginity.
Yes,
you can't do that.
Yeah, exactly. But so
you can on TV. Yeah.
So he, like a week or two ago, according to the television, he married the woman he met on The Bachelor, and they made a very big deal about how they were not having sex until after the wedding night, and so we went from this very chaste version of The Bachelor to this slightly skankier version of The Bachelor.
The chlamydia factory version.
Yeah, reassuring you that nothing had really changed.
Yes.
You know, The Bachelorette is the sister program, which is equally skanky and demeaning to all the parties. But I know this because, and I shouldn't say this, but I will, my wife and daughter, it's a bonding experience. Mm-hmm. And several other women who I know to be very intelligent women watch with their daughters. And I think
– both of the shows or
– both of the shows. Yeah, okay. And so if I come in the room and I begin to make fun of the show, which I do every time it's on, my daughter will pause the TV and say, do you have anything good to say? Then get out.
Yeah.
And I don't have anything good to say because I tried to have this serious conversation. Like, real love is actually, you know, a combination of circumstance, fortunate circumstance, and really hard work. And, like, she doesn't want to know about that. She wants it to this TV version where there's an island involved.
Well, do you really believe she thinks they're finding love on the show?
I don't know.
Because really what the show is about is, like, people behaving crazily for,
I think you're
episodes.
Asking the wrong question. I think you should be asking him, do you really believe you can watch it, walk into a room where people are watching The Bachelor and talk to them about what real love is?
Yeah.
And ask them what they're bonding over.
There's a conspiracy somewhere in here, James. What is it?
Yeah, I think so. It's desperation of a rapidly disintegrating cable universe with smaller and smaller channels that you've got to do something.
Yeah.
Well, I think also when people – these kinds of shows, I think they sort of are about – I mean, I'm not surprised to hear that your wife and daughter are watching this show because they are about norms, you know, and they're about – I mean, the cable show, the show itself has its own presumed set of norms, like what's right and what's wrong and stuff like that. But everybody has their own opportunity to impart their own life lessons. So I assume your wife and your daughter are looking at these things and endorsing some of the behaviors and not endorsing others and thrashing through them. It probably is a pretty useful thing to do with your daughter. I mean, to sort of talk through, well, don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, but I could do at the theme music.
It wouldn't be as much
and
fun.
I could just
though.
Say, don't do that, and then save yourself an hour.
Yeah, it wouldn't be as much fun your way. All right, we have to take a little break here so we can get back in time to talk to you about Sochi. There's so much to say. It's changing every minute. We'll be right back. All right. Oh, we're back, actually. I was distracted by what they were talking about. All right. So welcome back to our show. We're going to be talking about Sochi here. I'll give out the phone number now because I know it's hard to get a word in edgewise with this group, but you might try 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. I also want to mention that next week, speaking of The Bachelor, we are doing a show, I believe on the day before Valentine's Day, on Thursday, about a love. It's going to take a very special approach to love, and I don't want to say too much about it, but I do want to say that if you go to WNPR.org right now, there's a sort of a voicemail project where we're asking you to call in and tell us a story about when you knew, the moment you knew that love was real, or that when you knew that love was not real. Do I have that right, Wolfie? Is that what the thing? I think that's what we agreed on. So anyway, so that's at WNPR.org. You can get the phone number there. Call in. Tell your story. I'm not quite sure what use we'll make of it. We'll turn it over to the NSA or something. And we're proceeding here with Jim Chapdelaine and James Hanley and Teresa Kramer. We are going to shift gears to Sochi. And there's so many different ways to kind of approach this. And even as we speak, things are changing quite a bit. They had these ceremonies today. I don't want to be doing any spoilers for anybody who's planning to watch tonight. Although there's no way you're going to get tonight and not know and not find out that one of the rings did not light up.
No, I saw that on Gawker already. Yeah.
Which is symbolic of something anyway.
Inadequate power supply. Yeah.
And so, James,
of various kinds.
James, here you don't really have to look for a conspiracy. I mean, you know, from the awarding of the games to Russia in 2007 to now, it all looks like one gigantic conspiracy, or I think, as you said, the activities of gangsters. So I'll let you have the floor for a while.
Well, yeah, I mean, I sort of think that it's time to somehow for athletes to have something different. You know, like the Olympic name, of course, is the absolute sort of, you know, the gold standard, as it were. But it's really a mask for something that is totally corrupt at this point, I think. I mean, the whole thing about having this massive event, winter sports in a sort of semi-tropical resort for a start, extremely expensive, lots of hidden costs. We have costs. I mean, what have we got? Like two battleships or something? You know, like cruising the Black Sea and airplanes on hold on European airports. You know, to fly people out in case something happens. Meanwhile, it's the political background to it really is trying to endorse what is absolutely an incredibly corrupt regime where there's a lot of bad things going on. It's not just anti-gay activity. It's virtually anything progressive. I mean, if you've watched the two members of Pussy Riot on TV this week talking about Russia, and I mean, there are so many things wrong there that the only good thing I can see about it is the fact that the president isn't there. That, you know, that they figured would be just sort of, you know, okay. The White House probably figured that was the last straw, you know, that you really don't want to do. But it's just all of the falsehood of it. And then I was listening to a report about it, and there was this reporter saying, oh, you know, it's so great now that the games have started and we can just look at the blue skies and the snow and we can, you know, forget about the weird toilets and the toilet paper you can't flush down the toilet and the dogs in the room, the unexpected dogs. Oh, by the way, we're killing thousands of dogs. All of these things. We can forget all of that and enjoy the purity of
sport.
I like
the reason they're killing all the dogs. Because a ski jumper could land on one.
Yes, right. I mean, it's this nether world of total unreality, and the problem is huge amounts of money on it. That you know, all sorts of hidden things and hidden subsidies and you know, hidden deals. The whole thing, really, I don't know.
Well, it puts NBC in an interesting position because, as you say, I mean, they tend to put a pretty blue skies approach on things. Although Bob Costas in China, I give the guy a lot of props. He really did engage in some pretty challenging interviews and some pretty challenging commentary about the sort of dark side of all that. But in general, it's kind of a blue skies approach. Although Teresa Kramer now chiming in from the world of snark.
Yeah.
I mean, another approach to the Olympics, which many of the events are not terribly interesting.
Yeah.
But for a person with your particular temperament and mindset, you know, I mean, all the things that don't work could be as fascinating or more fascinating than anything else.
You read my mind, Colin. I really don't care what happens on the field at all. Ski jumping is the most boring thing I've ever seen in my life. And But to – I would watch if there were stray dogs running on the course because it would be hilarious.
And yet may happen.
Yes. And I actually read a Jezebel article that sort of had the same take on it that James does. It's like, I may just have to sit this one out because it's just too corrupt and terrible and there's too many horrible things going on. And I'm sitting here being like, no, I want to watch Putin fail miserably. I want this to be just the most public disaster for him, and I want to laugh at it all.
Well, it's
he's looking at me. Very suspiciously.
I'm listening, but I can tell you that Canada is looking pretty good right now.
Yeah.
I watched what were mostly trials last night, mm-hmm. and I happened to tune in when it was like the Brolympics, and it was like just, and I was expecting this otherness, this sort of Eastern Bloc mm-hmm. otherness, and just these were like, gnarly dudes
right.
just kind of like doing their thing. And then it started getting a little weird. But I have
don't
to
you
confess.
Don't you suspect that the snowboarders, some of them probably, have their PhDs in Lacanian theory or something, but they have to talk like
they have to adopt that language and those mannerisms.
About 14 brain cells.
Yeah, because one guy clearly got a prejudice score. He did a great, a triple gnarly summy
right.
snacker. And no one had done it, and he didn't make the final. And they said, well, how are you feeling? He goes, unhappy, man. Unhappy. Like, this is the Olympics, and you're unhappy about it.
I was watching him. He was that guy, and he was so I was like, I think I rotated on my axis pretty cool.
He
probably, has his PhD from Brown or something like that, but you have to talk like that.
Right. And so I was waiting, but I have to confess the sole reason that I'm watching the Olympics at all is curling.
Have you ever been curling?
I haven't been. I would like to. It's pretty far from here, like Southbury or something like that.
But there's one in Bridgeport.
Norfolk used to have the curling place, right? And it burned. I don't know if they replaced it or not, but Norfolk, Connecticut.
Putin, according to James, Putin burned that thing to the ground.
17 years ago.
Yeah. So other than that, I really don't care what happens. Mm-hmm. But the peripheral stuff is much bigger than it's ever been with any other, even China,
mm-hmm.
When they had three-year-old gymnasts. Their controversy was in the Olympics. This controversy is the fact that the roads aren't built. They spent $51 billion, the fact that there's hotel rooms that are just sort of exploding in the middle of the night and bunk beds that are a 2x4.
Well, that's kind of the beauty of this is that, China just there was a 30 Rock episode where Wesley Snipes, the English guy, tells Liz that he can't go back to London before the Olympics because they just don't have that kind of control over their people and after the Beijing Olympics. And that's sort of what's happening to Putin is he's got this communist legacy to deal with, and so you think they're going to be this totalitarian nation, but he can't even get someone to build a hotel,
for $51 billion dollars.
Yeah.
But then the communist conspiracy reared its head with the toilets with a row of chairs in front of the toilets.
They've already had some problems, for example, issuing a statement saying that our cameras are revealing that people are leaving the showers on when they're not using them. People mm-hmm. are going, your cameras are revealing
right.
something in the showers. however, I just want to quickly say about this that another thing that I'm seeing here, just take it kind of geopolitical for a second, is the length of the cycles, all right? So Putin gets this, or Russia gets this in 2007, when Putin really is sort of – he has a different – profile in the world in 2007. He's not quite as ridiculed and reviled as he is right now. And in fact, he's sort of seen as a guy who's pulling Russia up off of its knees.
Still wearing a shirt.
Yeah. And maybe actually doing a little bit of battle with the oligarchs, about sort of who this country is going to wind up belonging to. And Russia is rising at that point. Now Russia is actually in a downturn and the $50 billion is starting to look like less of a bad idea. However, the flip side of that is with a state-controlled media, and by the way, they just have effectively shut down, I don't know if you saw this one, the one non-state-controlled television network. The state didn't do it. They just mysteriously, all the cable operators suddenly dropped this thing called Rain TV. Apparently because of an online poll they did about the Battle of Leningrad. you would think wouldn't be that big of a hot button at this point, but in some ways maybe it is, and Putin's from Leningrad and stuff like that. But you know, the amount of control that they have means probably that Putin himself won't take that big a hit among the Russian people. I mean, obviously, how he's understood in the rest of the world is a completely separate subject. But, you know, among the Russian people, even if this thing is kind of – doesn't work that well and they could have really used that $50 billion as a different kind of economic stimulus that really would have helped their country, which is a mess right now economically. Even so, my guess is Putin comes out of this okay in Russia. I mean, he may be something else to the rest of us. But feel free to disagree.
Well, one of the things I would think too is that this has taken the news media's attention away from Ukraine, for example.
Yeah.
What is happening there? What's going to happen after the Olympics are over? Which is the real story. And I think that it's certainly – his image has certainly changed over the years enough that this is a different place from when they gave him the Olympics. But I think that when they gave him the Olympics, there was certainly a lot of doubt about whether that was the right thing to be doing in a country that was really chaotic in many ways. And what was involved there in that decision certainly wasn't one that really was thought out as saying, well, you know, we need to help these guys out and they're on an upward arc. I don't think that that was the case at all. I think that talk about conspiracy theories. I mean, there's a whole, you know, sort of book full of conspiracy theories about why the Olympic Committee would award it to Russia in Sochi. But I think that one of the things that's being lost in this whole thing, there are some reporters who are actually doing some reporting about, you know, what is the real nature of the Russian government and what is happening in Ukraine and which is the geopolitical background to this whole thing. And I think that is really that's going to emerge right after the Olympics, I think, as to exactly where he is, who he is.
Just reading about it, I'm just reminded of how incredibly complicated Russia is and how complicated its political structure is. And every time you think you have a simple answer or a straight-on take about something, it gets wrinkled up and changed around.
Right.
And just as of perhaps simplistic example of that, we're going to close out this conversation. This week, two members of the Russian punk group / collective Pussy Riot were touring America. They made a stop on the Stephen Colbert show, the Colbert Report, where they were a pretty big hit. You could see that they actually kind of had Colbert periodically buffaloed in a way that he enjoys being buffaloed. He'll hear just a little bit of that.
You seem like a nice couple of kids. What I don't understand is why you would be going against someone like Vladimir Putin, who is just trying to preserve the peace and bring Russia into a brighter future. What do you have against Vladimir Putin? He's a strong man. That's what Russia needs.
We have different ideas about a bright future, and we don't want a shirtless man on a horse leading us into that bright future.
Vladimir and I get together shirtless and go hunting all the time. Sometimes we don't even get around to the hunting.
You should take some handsome boys with you.
Okay, well, let's talk.
So you hear that's the translator speaking. I think we've cut out the actual Russian part of that. So, seems pretty simple there anyway. Pussy Riot, good. Heroic dissidents. Vladimir Putin, bad. We get that. But as Jim alerted us, today, the Russian punk group Pussy Riot kicked those two women out. Its two most famous members, the other members of the collective, objected basically to all of their activities here in America. These two members are the ones who were jailed for staging an anti-Putin protest outside of Moscow Cathedral. Six other Pussy Riot members said that the two of them had strayed from, quote, the ideals of our group, feminism, separatist resistance, fight against authoritarianism, and personality cult. One particular sticking point was the Wayward Pair's recent appearance at an Amnesty International benefit concert alongside pop legend Madonna in front of thousands of screaming fans at the Barclays Center, all major departures from the band's underground ethos. So I didn't realize you could get kicked out of a collective.
I guess you can.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, it's a hall of mirrors, that whole thing. I mean, the collective, I don't know a great deal about the collective. I mean, there hasn't been really much background.
Well, these two people went to jail for their beliefs.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
I mean,
and they're going to go back, and they said they'd go to jail again. I mean, that shows a pretty fair amount of commitment, doesn't it?
Maybe the real question is, like, you know, there are no consequences to being kicked out. I mean, who's to stop them from going around and continuing to claim they're part of it? I mean, it's not like they stop getting paid.
It's not like it's Mike Love owning the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Yeah. The Beach Boys unless he says you can. I don't know the answer to that either, but it's just another example of how complicated this stuff is. Mm-hmm. You know, from our outside looking in, you would imagine that Pussy Riot would be pretty unified, you know, and that it would be these two members who heroically did go to jail and are now here in America doing what would seem to me to be Pussy Riot's version of the Lord's work, would be greeted with open arms if and when they got ready to come back to Russia. But apparently over there it's more complicated and just has more layers.
You know,
to
the
it.
Occupy movement sort of crumbled under the weight of its own democracy. The fact that we're not going to have leaders, we're not going to have anything except we're going to hang out here.
Well, also, I think that the very nature of the collective, so-called, has been changed by the fact that you have two major personalities who not only went to jail, but they emerged from jail with their fists held up and making insults of Putin and then coming on TV in the U.S. and sort of creating their own ethos around it. That the collective presumably is no longer a collective in the sense of equal members, mm-hmm. and the whole nature of what they're trying to do, they're essentially becoming political figures, whereas the ethos of the collective prior to that was to be sort of like creating disturbance of the political order.
More anarchistic.
And anarchistic, mm-hmm. right. And in an anarchic sort of semi-collective, you can't tolerate personalities suddenly becoming larger than life. And they certainly are being perceived. I mean, they hint at sort of political ambitions as well. And so I think that it's maybe not that surprising that they would be the collective back in Russia would be perhaps pretty unhappy about that.
Same thing happened to NSYNC when Timberlake got too big.
Yeah.
You just can't have superstars. All right, we have to take a break. I want to have time for endorsements when we come back.
You might have heard about the Sochi Games and the way the Russians are treating their games. Listen, Vladimir, Mr. President. Your new laws are good, only to be put in the garbage can.
The Olympic Host Committee announced today that biathlon skiers will be allowed to shoot at dogs. Do you get the feeling that all the joy is just seeping out of life? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Jane Ashley and Skylar Magnoli. Katie Talarski is our executive producer, and Greg Hill tweets for us a WNPR column and appeared in our intro. The part of Bill Curry was played by Art Fleming. For articles, show pages, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff shirtless, horseback riding with Putin, visit our website, WNPR.org. On Monday, it's the Scramble, special Sochi edition. And now, back to Colin.
All right, we're back. I have two things to tell you. First of all, the biathlon thing does remind me. I have to tell my favorite Jerry Seinfeld line about the biathlon. He says, you know, the biathlon, he goes, you ski and you shoot. You ski and you shoot. He said, is there one where you swim and you strangle a guy? I now have the phone number. So if you would like to help us with our show about modern love, which is on Thursday, February 13th, our official voicemail question is, tell us a story about when you started or stopped believing in romantic love. The number for that is 860-580-9677. 860-580-9677. If that was too fast, go to WNPR.org. We'll have a page set up about all of that. All right, time for endorsements. Our panel will tell you about things they know about that might make your life better. Teresa Kramer.
So down in Stratford, there is a place called the Nutmeg Clinic, and if you have an unspayed cat, you can get it spayed for $20.
I'm so glad that's what the Nutmeg Clinic
yes,
does.
Yes. Also, I just finished reading.
But that's pretty good. Let's just pause on that. Yeah. So you have an unspayed cat, and they'll do what?
They will spay it for $20.
For $20.
Yeah. So if you're one of those feral cat ladies or something, round them all up and take them down on the Nutmeg.
That's
clinic.
So Sochi. And is it just for the month of February, or is that?
Valentine's Day special or something.
Special. Yeah.
Yes. I also just finished reading a book called "This Is Where I Leave You" by Jonathan Tropper. I discovered that it was being made into a movie starring Tina Fey and Jason Bateman. So I ran out and got the book and read it. And it's hilarious. It's about a really dysfunctional family who is forced to sit Shiva together after the father dies, and all sorts of hilarity ensues.
All right. And eventually that one of them goes to the Nutmeg Clinic.
Yeah, gets the cat spayed.
All right. Yeah. James Hanley.
A great book by Susan Crawford called Captive Audience, which explains why even if you pay through the nose for your internet service, whenever you click on YouTube, for example, you get a spinning pizza wheel for a long time. It's an incredible book about the actual control of the telecommunications industry, which is an incredible, essentially a monopoly. Susan Crawford, The Captive Audience. We have at Cine Studio Casablanca for a couple of days, next Friday and Saturday, on the big screen for Valentine's Day. And there's also something that's really incredible, really different. Philippe Jaroussky, the countertenor, is singing with the Venice Baroque Orchestra at Jorgensen at UConn on February 23rd at 3 o'clock. And there's actually a discussion, I think, before the performance at like 2:15. But he has an incredible voice, and the Venice Baroque Orchestra is amazing. This is something really unusual, really special.
And you have Philomena right now, right?
That's right. Philomena starts on Sunday. We're showing Blue is the Warmest Color right now. Philomena starts on Sunday and runs through Thursday.
When you do go see Philomena and you're staring at the screen at the kind of mean magazine editor, the exploitive magazine editor saying, "Where have I seen her before?" It's Catelyn Stark from Game of Thrones. I'll do that work for you.
Great.
Well, those just actually blow away my endorsement. But I will say that I've been working a lot. But so when I'm working, I'll read a book of short stories or something. And I'm reading one called Labyrinths of Reason, and I think it explains a lot. In it, there's a sort of a mind puzzle, like how can we tell if we're actually here or if our brains are in a vat being controlled by an evil scientist? And then, of course, it occurred to me, like, well, how can that scientist be sure that his brain isn't in a vat, and who's controlling it? And it all boils down to Bill Nye, who's controlling everything and everyone in a vat.
Is this Nick Ostrom? Is that who you're
reading
about?
I think it might be.
Yeah. We actually did an entire show about this.
Yeah.
This is 3 or 4 years ago. How you know whether reality is real or whether you're living in a computer simulation.
Right.
And what kind of philosophical choices you would make if you knew the latter.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the whole hologram thing.
Right. And it is Bill Nye.
It is Bill Nye. All right. So.
yeah, right. It could have been Ham. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
So my endorsements, first of all, I mentioned her earlier on the show. Every once in a while, I just fall in love with a critic. And I've fallen in love with Willa Paskin of Slate Magazine. And one of the things that I love is a critic who can take something that I really liked and pull it apart in a way that challenges my own aesthetics. And Willa Paskin did that with American Hustle, a movie that I really enjoyed. And she kind of famously tore it to shreds in a way that I found very intriguing. But all of her stuff is good. The idea to talk today about The Bachelor came from a piece that she does. I would really just recommend doing some kind of Google alert or whatever you need to do to make sure you're seeing Willa Paskin, P-A-S-K-I-N. And then the other thing is I wish I could go back in time and sort of re-endorse Sybarite 5, this amazing five-person, obviously, string quartet who performed last night in Hartford. The next time they come through, you have to see it. They did these sort of kind of modern music repurposings of Radiohead songs. And then at one point did this lovely, absolutely melodic, harmonic, fascinating arrangement of Where Have All the Flowers Gone? And then at the end, one of their members said that was a tribute to the late Pete Seeger. It was done for us by Steve Metcalf. And that's like our Steve Metcalf. Our
wow.
Steve. Now, his daughter actually is in Sybarite 5. But this is an amazing group. You'll see them on 60 Minutes someday about, how serious music is becoming sexy again because there are all these fabulous-looking people playing this great music. Anyway, they're playing in Osaka in a couple of weeks, I think, so you can go see them there instead. All right, so thanks very much to James Hanley, Jim Chapdelaine, and Teresa Kramer. We'll be back on Monday with The Scramble. More Sochi.
Somebody shot this stray dog. Are you okay, dog?
Oh, I will be okay. I am a Russian dog. We are so tough. We drink vodka in our water bowls.
Really? Vodka in your water bowls? Do you have any you could share?
Yet. It's mine.